Donc, le titre de ma présentation est Undead and Undying, The Eternal Among Us, et ça va devenir évident pourquoi. Donc, good morning, colleagues, peers, and friends. Let me start out by saying how excited and honored I am to be here today. Honored because it's hugely gratifying and humbling to be speaking to kindred spirits who not only tolerate passions and interests like mine, but who actually share them and contribute to them every day in every conversation encountered, every book read, and every paper presented. You are here this morning at a conference entitled Figures de l'Immortel, Figures of the Immortal, because you chose a path that was unconventional, incredibly salient, and necessary in these times. But it's also exciting because you're all interested and polite academics who invited me here, and so now you have to listen to me wander on about my thesis. And who amongst us does not just love to jump into my thesis when given the opportunity? So thank you for inviting me here today. Although I was being a little facetious, I'm not really going to talk about my thesis much. I will mention my own research to get to the point in a pretty convoluted way. My background, which Marie mentioned briefly, is in literature. But as you all know, at one point in a graduate degree, we have to leave behind our ill-defined grandiose dreams of working on literature about women or racism in film. You tell your friends, my master's thesis is going to be on Game of Thrones. And when you tell them, they go, wow, that's so cool. I wish I could do a master's on Game of Thrones. And then you tell your potential thesis director, and she says, ha, 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 ha. No, seriously, what are you doing it on? In the course of becoming more specific, you do an awful lot of soul searching, but you also search for information that will guide you to a research question, a problématique that you can not only live with, but that you will come to love and know the way you love and know a favorite book, a favorite meal, a lover. One of my most jarring moments while I was doing my coursework for my PhD was when a student mentioned glibly in an informal seminar that you become your thesis. I couldn't miss the opportunity for a joke, so I quickly retorted that I was writing my dissertation on vampires, so she better watch out. But she was right. Some of you here are working on MA or PhD theses, or delving deeply into a research topic that held you in thrall until you decided to plumb its depths and explicate its importance. And through this process, you will find yourselves morphing into the principle, the concept, the creature with which you are fascinated. As for myself, my own graduate beginnings were particularly mercenary, as I started my master's degree as a research assistant on a project out of l'Université du Québec à Trois-Rivières called L'Emergence de la Science-Fiction Québécoise de l'Entre-deux-Guerres. It was the first time I was actually paid to read books and to give my opinion about them. Wow. At the time, I didn't give a tinker's damn about science fiction, and I cared even less about war. But when my voice was heard, I realized that I suddenly did care, that I did have an opinion, and that it had darn well better be lucid and coherently enunciated. I left the project, foolishly, to pursue studies in optometry, a solid, serious field of study, where I would be guaranteed a job after graduation. So 2 years of flipping lenses and spiritual anguish convinced me that I could work in the sciences. But I would have to agree to die a slow, languishing death. I started my real master's degree at McGill, where I used my newfound appreciation for science fiction. If the word science is mentioned, then it's serious, right? It's stable. And I parlayed it into a thesis on the perception of the future of motherhood and the new reproductive technologies in the works of 70s dystopian women writers. How's that for a point two? My first supervisor, Professor Darko Suvin, upon finding out that I had eschewed literature for optometry sometime before, asked me if I could really have completed a degree in that field. I was offended, And I replied, of course I could have completed it. And he said, no, of course you would have been capable of finishing it. But could you have limited yourself to that? And then it all made sense. I had never realized that my choice of a research topic had not been limited by necessities of graduate study that require you to narrow down your focus to a pinprick so as to guarantee originality. The fact that I researched feminist dystopias at a time when a document entitled Proceed with Care, the Final Report of the Royal Commission on New Reproductive Technologies was published and widely disseminated meant that I was an active participant in current events, a member with an opinion, albeit unfavorable, on the way that women's bodies were suddenly redefined and reassessed as objects in a race to produce the first test tube baby. My research meant that my voice counted and through it was heard. When I decided on a PhD dissertation subject, I realized that I wanted finally to be one of the cool kids who needs to choose a topic that would send me on wacky and dangerous research adventures. After all, when I finished this last diploma, I would be forced into the stodgy, dusty world of academe, where I would probably teach Shakespeare and Marlowe and start speaking in iambic pentameter. So I chose to work with vampires. How cool is that? I made arrangements to visit a coven. I never got there. To go to Transylvania, I did that. And I became my thesis. And it is during that point in time, when my imposter syndrome was at its worst, that I remember listening to a fellow student before my Œuvre de la littérature mondiale class here, proclaiming that she wanted to do something practical and useful for society with her degree. Je ne veux pas que pelleter des nuages. I agreed and I nodded vehemently, and I had no idea what she meant. I wanted to ask her what she would do with her newly minted degree. She could use it to teach sentence structures to high school students, to offer fragments of opinions on the authors she particularly admired, or at worst, she could use her hefty dissertation to prop up her computer if the table was too low. But that comment by her, combined with my friend's still impressed, but more inquisitive, vampires, cool, but what are you going to do with that, started to nag at me more insistently. One of my Transylvanian friends, Elena, a Romanian structural engineer, said, a thesis on vampires do not exist. Finish. So I set out to show how changing religious values in Western societies affected the representation of the vampire figure in film and literature to the point where he became a repository not only for the sacrilegious, but also for the religious, for the divine. I completed my thesis shortly after 9/11, and I realized once again how, when I started closely examining the content of my chapters and the arguments that I used to convince my defense committee that there was a tangible correspondence between the vampire and shifting religious and spiritual values of our North American society, which had been shaken to its core. I started to see how my safe, privileged space that I had glorified and taken for granted had to learn to reassess and redefine itself with respect to the rest of the world, and how, although my own Quebecois society scoffed at the restrictions and dictates that the church had once put upon us, I was still very much a subject of the Judeo-Christian spacetime that had made me, and how this would not suffice if I wanted to contribute to a better world. My once cool vampire suddenly took on a lot more importance in his diachronic representation, and in order to understand him and those who had created him, I had to learn the meaning of alterité. My vampire became fully fleshed out, to borrow a turn of phrase, not only because he was frightening, but because he was frightening and undead. Indeed, when I started talking to fellow students and colleagues about my interests, I got so many suggestions of where I should take my research. My political science friends obviously wanted me to continue the metaphor of the vampire as emblem of ravenous capitalism. My fangirl and fanboy friends wanted me to focus on the works of fill in the blank because she's so cutting edge. And my philosophically inclined friends saw the vampire as emblematic of the works of Marx, Engels, Zizek, Hegel. And none of them were wrong. The vampire truly is immortal, not because he had transcended the centuries and managed to leave his mark in every culture, except North American indigenous culture, but because his undead heart beat out the pulse of the society he inhabited at a given time, in a given place. The title of my dissertation was Unholy Transubstantiation, Christifying the Vampire and Demonizing the Blood. I even designed a tidy Cartesian graph complete with X and Y axes of the path the figure of the vampire took from the early Middle Ages through modernity to today, plotting the contrapositives of blood diseases versus public perception of the figure of the revenant slash vampire against a backdrop of literary and social currents. That was my nod to science, my parting comment to my classmate, tu vois, moi non plus je ne pète pas des nuages. Tout devient sérieux et scientifique quand on le positionne sur un graphique. Terry Cochran, my thesis director, bless his tolerant heart, shook his head and said, mais tu n'en as pas besoin. Ta théorie fonctionne sans ton graphique. Mais garde-le si tu y tiens. Thank God he's not here right now. He'd forgive me. It was pretty and it was colorful and it validated my work, I thought. So I kept it. And I still show it from time to time for the wow factor, but Terry was right, and I did not need it. Comparatists and philosophers and writers and creators do not need the blessing of the sciences, although we have been bamboozled into thinking we have. We are worthy without science, with a capital S's approval, and our impact will be felt far and wide. But what do people like us do in real life? When I explain that je suis comparatiste, I often get, ça mange quoi en hiver, un comparatiste? Fair enough. We are gathered today to exhume and laud and berate and define and circumscribe the figure of the immortal. Thankfully, our forebears, our kindred spirits who precede us, have forged the path we are on today. Percy Bysshe Shelley, husband of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley of Frankenstein fame, author of works such as Prometheus Unbound, Ozymandias, and The Daemon of the World, belonged to the early 19th century Romantic school of literature, so named 100 years after its greatest writers had published their works, in particular, the Satanic school of Romantic poets. Along with many other greats, such as Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, Lord Polidori, and John Keats. Shelley wrote poetry and prose copiously, and his output remained steady throughout his life, but publishers often saw fit to distance themselves from him for fear of being taken to task, or even arrested for blasphemy or sedition. Shelley's poetry may have been considered underground art during his day, but his poetic achievements are widely recognized today, and how many of us here have not at least heard of Percy Shelley in our literature courses? Shelley's production was not limited to artful writing. However, his art underpinned and informed his advanced political and social thought and influenced politicians and statesmen in ways that reach down to this very day. It is known that Shelley's theories of economics and morality, taught in tandem, had a profound influence on Karl Marx and Mahatma Gandhi. Says Shelley in his Defense of Poetry, and I quote, poets are not only the authors of language and of music, of the dance and architecture and statuary and painting. They are the institutors of laws and founders of civil society. Poets, says Shelley, are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Shelley had understood almost 200 years ago how words and their production, manipulation, and dissemination could be perceived as instruments of intellectual freedom and a vehicle for political and social subjugation. Centuries before Shelley, Plato himself, in his discussion of Theomania, had postulated that poets, amongst others, were possessed by a divine madness, touched by God. And while I'm not suggesting that we will shortly start to walk about speaking in tongues, what I am suggesting is that by our very intellectual curiosity and our practice of following a thought, a concept, an idea to its logical extension to understand its wellspring and ultimate destiny, our very willingness to accept the other's journey as a compliment, a validation, a mirror of our own, we are making very necessary and precious sense of this world we are part of. Indeed, it is not only our prerogative to share and explicate our perceptions, fears, and apprehensions, but our duty to document and critique. We may, as Plato said, have to be imbued with a divine madness in order to understand our world today and to make sense of it. Plato felt that poets had to be imbued with a divine madness, but perhaps although the poet may feel she is going mad, the world around them is the one that seems to be lapsing into senselessness and insanity today. To borrow a term from modern noir cinema, when we turn on the television or read the daily news, we may feel we are being gaslighted by those serving up our society in bite-sized bites, slices of politics with a side of contempt or ridicule. The small child who will point out that the emperor has no clothes will be shushed by the multitudes who have lost their hearing due to the emperor's insistent baying that his are the finest, most incredible clothes in history. And they will continue to buy the myths, to believe the hype, to drive the bandwagon that will, they think, carry them to their utopian Mar-a-Lago, where they will all share in the spoils promised to them by their benefactor. And that bandwagon will go flying right over the cliff and drive them right into the ground. And it is then that the crazies who foresaw this will be understood, where the Cassandras will be vindicated, and we will breathe a sigh of relief. Which brings me back to my basic idea, we are the Cassandras. Now, more than ever, we need to understand our worth and purpose. We will be swayed by harsh winds that try to push us in the direction of those following the trends and giving in to the privileged path of least resistance and populist dictates. At this moment, we seem to be in the clutches of a force field of anti-intellectualism that threatens to ride roughshod over us, our ideals, our careful approach, and appreciation of différence, and in the way we make room for the other. In the way we have, through our apprenticeship to mentors we still follow and thinkers we emulate, understood that the world is not black and white, cut and dried. That although we seem to have taken many, many steps backward, we understand that progress cannot be unmade. However we define progress. Because the truth we embrace as beauty is not only beautiful, it is unending, immortal. And that is why we are here today. That is why we are gathered around this table, contributing our views and visions of the figure of the immortal, and giving our various versions and explaining how integral they are to the fabric of our society. Our microcosm, yes, privileged perhaps, but also its influence on our macrocosm. And it needs us and our ideas and our perspectives and our divine madness. I was given the opportunity recently to guest lecture a class for Professor Eberle Sinatra on Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. It was fun to review and reread the novel for my presentation, but one young woman who had a valid point for discussion afterward prefaced her comment with, "I don't want to dig too deeply into this issue, though." I assured her that she could never dig too deeply or analyze too thoroughly or see too much. Indeed, the reverse is probably true, in that it seems too much of the world doesn't want to dig deeply or analyze at all, or even harbor a pretense of wanting to see anything differently than what has been commonly accepted. And this brings me back to, what is it that academics like you and I do? Some of us teach. We teach now, or we'll teach after our degree is done, or we're thinking that we don't really want to end up teaching. The bottom line is that we have a huge responsibility, in that we have the pressures from those who will benefit or profit from our courses and want to capitalize on our skills, and for whom we forever walk a tightrope of holding back a lot to let out a little and make it not only relevant, but interesting. For those of you who will end up teaching students in a non-literary sphere, you will find yourself imbuing your lessons with use value. You too will get the, "We like you and everything, but why do we need to take your courses?" We will pass on the most significant novels of the past century, the Man Booker / Neustadt / Hugo and Nebula prize winners, the canon gatekeepers. In the process, we will also pass on to children and adults alike our insight and experience and the benefit of a variety of opinions. We will teach people how to understand symbols, but we will also guide their thought and appreciation of words, written, spoken, implied. Very often, whether we like it or not, we will be the front line of authority. We will be the greatest totem of literary hegemony, even as we attempt to dismantle the canonical in order to understand it and how it works on us and for or against us. The most, bitter philosophical argument I have ever had in my life was with an author whom I consider to be, ironically, a friend and a political genius. Her position on global hegemonies in general and academe in particular struck a very personal chord with me. Many educators, she believes, hold positions unfairly and are chosen by institutional powers that be to perpetuate harmful stereotypes at best and damaging and untruthful propaganda at worst. Those who should be allowed to speak and make their voices heard are often shut out. The disenfranchised continue to be held at bay, although the words from within profess to speak on their behalf, to tell their stories. I have pointed this out many, many times in many ways. Teachers are a practicing academic hegemony. Our classrooms are our pulpits. Our course packs are our Bibles. This is why, to briefly venture into popular culture, use the force, Luke, but only to do good. This force is, indeed, our readings and writings and discussions and analyses. Those of us who do not or will not teach are researchers and writers. We are the ones who keep our finger on the pulse of the social and historical, while always looking over our shoulders and out toward the horizon, because our divine madness keeps us sensing the changes in the air. We write because we probably cannot even remember a time when we could not write. We scope out and report on the most intangible as well as the immediately experiential. We must frustratingly and sometimes painfully reach beyond the obvious and the apparent around us, unfortunately, but especially when the immediate surroundings are going preternaturally well. We always need to ask, for whom are things going swimmingly? Even though our comfort and complacency and, dare I say it, privilege, don't really encourage us to sally forth in that direction. We need to penetrate, verbalize, and enunciate the zeitgeist of our times. And today, we find ourselves doing just that with our geists, taking on many different forms and functions. We are indeed speaking and writing and publishing from an elitist position. But it is this very position, ironically, that permits us to interrogate all elitisms and to appoint ourselves the stewards of the repository, melting pot, and launching pad of perspective and alterity. Lest I am making us sound like fantastic beasts or the divine undying beings we are presenting on and discussing this weekend, we do not function on an ethereal plane. But contrary to many, our work is not cut out for us. We do not graduate from solidly implemented curricula and economically stable departments. We do not have clear-cut professions hollowed out for us. To the question, ça mange quoi un comparatiste en hiver? Well, bien souvent, ça mange pas gros. But seriously, the fact that our professions are ill-defined does not mean that our ambition is as well. More often than not, our calling finds us before we even try to seek it out. In the scroll-down boxes where we tick off nurse or architect or cook, we will not find comparatist or legislator of the world. We must often forge our own way, create our own niches, and it is in this very quest that we will reach our audiences and find our students to teach and continue our legacy. No discussion of the figure of anything would be complete without the specter of Eric Auerbach brandishing his figura. My own undead figura was that of the vampire figure, in the true Auerbachian sense, of what served to approach the problem in my own research of the ultimate repository of how sexual and religious ambivalence are combined in the character of the vampire, where the figure of the undead suggests a historical personage or event which prefigures a later one, with the latter shown to be expressed as subject vampire, with, as its precursor, that of Jesus Christ. I was alluding to the description Auerbach makes of figura at a specific time when it was, and I quote, the figure which was then regarded as the most important and seemed before all others to merit the name of figura was the hidden illusion in its diverse forms. The vampire figure is not anchored down in history. Rather, it moves through history by virtue of the fact that it embodies the religious slash sexual tensions of particular historical moments. From the earliest frightful revenant reported in folklore to the soul-searching, God-fearing creature for which we willfully suspend our disbelief, the vampire has been subjected to historically dependent transformations and mutations. This is why, in part, the vampire, to me, will always be pertinent. He will carry on in our imaginations and our histories, transcending our own foibles and mishaps. His own immortality is proof of ours, if not in our bodily configurations, then in our spiritual and intangible manifestations. The vampire, in the figure of the immortal, is the very figure, par excellence, of what we are through what we do. The work we do will never die. Our ideas will live on in our writings to be debated and extrapolated on. Our research, sometimes indefinable and arcane, will never be futile if it moves even one soul. Nothing we do, think, or feel and transmit in our publications is for naught. Ours, however, is a satisfaction that, more often than not, will come at a later date. We must carry proudly our standard of the immortal, of the undead, knowing that our craft, which is the vehicle for our ideas and our contribution to this life, is far from an airy, insubstantial nuage à être pelleté. Our figure of the immortal, of the undead, is indeed the ghost of everything that is or was alive. Stand out and be counted, it must, because right now, boys and girls, there are an awful lot of zombies we need to fight. Thank you.